This program is underwritten by the Greater Haines Chamber of Commerce, advocating for a supportive business community.
The following program is a production of KHNS. It does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Board of Directors and staff of Lynn Canal Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee. This is Lynn Canal Voice, a public affairs show from the KHNS newsroom. I'm reporter Abby Collins, and today we're talking about a negotiated timber sale announced by the University of Alaska earlier this year. But before that discussion, let's take a look at recent and upcoming news in the Upper Lynn Canal. Reporter Henry Leisha is here with me. Hey, Henry, what's on your radar right now?
So there's a couple stories I've been working on this week. Recently, the police posted a notice reminding residents that they will be cited and penalized if they let their dogs roam unattended, which, you know, sounds kind of like a silly reminder, but there have been several incidents in the last month involving loose dogs. Wildlife has been disturbed. There were some moose calves that were chased by roaming dogs. A resident's cat was killed by two roaming dogs, and a young boy was bit by a roaming dog. So it is a pretty serious issue that the police will be taking seriously. And then earlier this week, the Yukon Avalanche Association announced that they have secured funding from the Yukon government for a weather station in the Haines Pass. And this is a pretty exciting development because there aren't a lot of weather stations that are close to this region, but backcountry skiers really rely on good forecasting of conditions to stay safe in this area. So the Yukon Avalanche Association is going to be working with the Haines Avalanche Center to install this new station, which is pretty exciting. And then kind of coming up on my radar, the Klukwan Library is going to be recording stories for the Chilkat Stories, Our Village, Our Lives project. They're hoping to document and preserve stories, not just from elders, but tribal members of all ages, to increase knowledge and interest in the community's heritage. So hopefully going to be having a story about that project pretty soon.
Great. And I am fresh off a Tuesday assembly meeting in Haines. I've covered the borough's move toward a publicly funded program for waste disposal. And also on Tuesday, the assembly supported a Department of Transportation grant for LUTAC dock funding, and they endorsed the Chilkat River Access Working Group's recommendation to the Alaska Department of Transportation on the next phase of the highway project. And we also have our eye on fisheries right now. We'll be checking in with Fish and Game each week to monitor the strength of fish runs in this district. And that's all for right now in the KHNS local news. So we're going to turn back to our main conversation. That's KHNS reporter Henry Leisha checking in with us about this week's news. Thanks, Henry.
Thank you.
We'll be covering those stories as they develop, and you can always find those that we've already done at khns.org. I'm Abby Collins, and this is Lynn Canal Voice. In March, the University of Alaska announced it's negotiating the sale of timber on 13,400 acres of its land in the Haynesboro. The 10-year negotiated sale is estimated to generate 150 million board feet and $10 million. And since that announcement, the proposed sale has drawn both excitement from members of the community who see a big economic opportunity, an opportunity for local jobs, but also concern from residents who fear the sale of this size could have long-lasting environmental impacts on the Chilkat Valley. And last month, the University Board of Regents heard public testimony and received many different opinions from throughout the valley. Just want to play a few of those comments for you right now.
I fully support the timber sale. I think it would be a great benefit to Haines. It will help the decreasing enrollment in the schools and allow people to live here and be able to plan for the future.
And I am concerned particularly about some of the logging that might take place right in the Bald Eagle Preserve where we do our rafting tours, in terms of just the impact possibly on the fisheries and also just on the view shed for the tourists that are floating down looking for more of a wilderness sort of feel.
I would like to say please go forward with this opportunity for diversity and economic development for Haines for the next 10 years. Please move forward with the timber harvest.
My neighborhood is near the traditional Tlingit village of Klekwan and is situated in the midst of the largest single block of university land slated for clear-cutting in the current university land use plan. This clear-cut would be devastating for our neighborhood, painful for our family, damaging for our viewshed and property values, catastrophic for the wildlife with whom we are blessed to dwell.
Again, a lot of different opinions here in the Valley on this timber project, so this hour we're going to take a closer look at it, the varying opinions and what it could mean for the Valley. We have a packed house here in the studio today, a lot of different people with me, so many that we're sharing microphones, but I first want to start off the conversation with a few guests joining us on the phone. From Anchorage, we have Jim Johnson, the president of the University of Alaska. Hi, Jim. Thanks for being here.
Hi, good morning, Abby. My pleasure.
And also on the phone is Christine Klein, the university's director of land management. Christine, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for having us.
Jim, I want to start off with you. Could you just tell me first about the history of these lands in the Chilkat Valley and how the university obtained them and for what purpose?
Well, I can speak generally about our land grant, Abby. Tough for me to speak about these particular lands. We are a land-grant university. Back in 1862, President Lincoln signed a law called the Morrill Act creating land-grant universities. And the whole idea was to fund public universities across the country through the development of lands. And then those funds would go into supporting educational programs. So exactly the kind of thing we've done. And back in 1915, we became a land-grant college. We got some land back then, 110,000 acres. And we've received another 40,000 or so over the years, gifts from people and purchases. So that's where we are at this point. I would note that even though we're a huge state, only Delaware got a smaller land grant than we did. So our lands, what little we have been very careful and responsible stewards of. And again, the primary purpose of these lands given us by the federal government is to develop for educational purposes. We've done that responsibly, I think, over the years, and we will absolutely continue to do that generally and absolutely in the context of this specific project.
Now, looking at this specific project, I was tuned into your presentation to the Board of Regents earlier this month. One of the things I saw in that presentation was that you noted the actual acreage for this sale could be significantly less than the 13,400 acres presented, depending on environmental regulations and other factors. Can you talk at all about that?
Well, sure, Abby. I mean, we are going to negotiate with the contractor, and we'll take into account many different factors. We will certainly, we've heard concerns from the community, no doubt about it. So those are in our minds as we go through the negotiations. We also have to actually assess the value of the timber in this area. We don't know what that is yet. We have some early assessments of it. We've got a very skilled timber expert who's had a look, but we need to really get together with the contractor and do the cruising of the property and really come to understand what's there. Some of the concerns that you reflected in the early comments here in terms of view sheds, the eagles, fisheries, et cetera, all will be in consideration as we sit down with the contractor and negotiate.
Christine, a question for you. This sale is estimated to generate $10 million over the course of this 10-year project. Can you talk specifically about where that money will go and how significant is $10 million for the University of Alaska?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the estimate is $10 million. Our estimates actually have ranged depending on, as you may recall, we had area of the Chilkat of 400 acres in there at one point, and that has been taken off. So it had ranged from $10 to $15 million, depending on how easy it was to help coordinate access and how much cost would go into the infrastructure. The money is used for, the funds are used for the University Land Grant Endowment Trust, and that fund helps pay for a number of different educational programs here at the university. We are a big funder of Cooperative Extension Service, so I'm really excited that they had some recent activity going on in Haines and updates for the community. We also fund or help assist fund some fisheries programs, marine, some oceanography, as well as some of the original programs of our original university there in agriculture and mining. We help some of those programs. But what we're most proud of is our UA Scholars Program, and that funds a full scholarship for the top 10% of high school, Alaskan high school students that graduate in their high school are eligible for a $12,000 scholarship to attend any one of the campuses, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, and the rural campuses as well. And we have to date funded over 9,000 students now. So that makes us particularly proud and is one of the things that my department and staff really get excited about in terms of it directly benefiting and seeing the results in the students. We also fund the foster students. We fund about 30 foster students here in Alaska a year, and helping them to move on in their lives and careers. So that gives you probably a pretty good overview of, I probably have forgotten some programs, but those are the main ones that we help fund.
And my second question was just for some perspective, how significant is $10 million in the funding of those programs?
Well, if I could, it's very significant. You know, a full tuition scholarship here is $7,000 a year. So, you know, divide the big number into that. You can see if we spent it all on tuition scholarships for students, how many students we could help, literally thousands. Funding the Alaska Scholars Program is critically important. We're in our 19th year, I believe it is, at this point. Over 9,000 students have received this support. And that's gold for those students. It's helped those students make it through, reduce their debt. You know, that's a big topic in the news these days. So anything we can do to support excellence in Alaska and excellence at our university and opportunity for our students is a top priority for us. And again, this is the very purpose of land-grant universities from the very start over 150 years ago is to do exactly the kind of thing we're talking about here.
I have a question from a listener that fits into this topic. She asked, rather than large-scale logging, has the university considered other forms of fundraising that could bring revenue to scholarship programs? And has the university asked UA students for innovative ideas that are both environmentally and socially responsible? That's what she wants to know.
Well, absolutely. We are just about to embark on our first ever statewide philanthropic campaign to raise more private sector money in support of the university. We have a foundation. It has been raising money for many, many years. So it funds a lot of scholarships, that's for sure, and we'll be doing more of that. I would say, though, to that caller, that we will be developing this particular project in a socially and in an environmentally conscious way. We are proud of the developments that we have already managed in the state, and we are committed to all projects, but this project in particular, to manage it in a constructive way that'll benefit the community and also will incorporate and reflect a number of the concerns that we have heard in our open house in the community and the open call from our Board of Regents and in other inputs that we've received.
Another question from a listener. Is the university open to parcel buyouts, land exchange, carbon banking for the lands in the Haynesboro?
We have looked. I mean, we've been open to that. We have looked at those options. We have engaged consultants to advise us, particularly in the carbon credit issue. We have talked with others in Alaska who have done that. And the preliminary indications are that it does not pencil out financially for us. But we continue to be open to alternatives.
So a portion of the acreage involved in the sale falls within the bounds of the Chilkatbal Legal Preserve, as has been talked about quite a bit. That preserve was created in the 80s to protect the world's largest concentration of bald eagles and their habitat, but the university's lands are exempt from the restrictions, certain restrictions of the preserve, meaning this extraction of lumber would be legal. But I want to talk a little bit more about those lands, and I want to bring in Ben Kirkpatrick, another guest in my studio here in Haines. Ben is the president of the Tokchinook Watershed Council Board and a former habitat biologist for northern Southeast Alaska. He is the conservation advisor for the Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Abby. Thank you for inviting me.
And so, Ben, you work with the Advisory Council for the Preserve, and that council earlier this year asked the university not to log those lands that fall within the bounds of the Bald Eagle Preserve, though it is legal. Can you talk a little bit about that request?
Well, the Advisory Council felt that given the existing knowledge, which was very minimal, that we could not support logging in the Eagle Preserve at all. The university did receive the land well before the Eagle Preserve was founded, but also scientific knowledge expanded greatly after the university received this land. It was unknown about the hydraulic effects of the Sirku and Chilkat on the chum salmon, which then in turn support the bald eagles population in the preserve. So we do hope that the university will see fit to exempt those lands specifically due to the sensitive nature that has been learned since they received this land.
Jim or Christine, do you want to respond to Ben?
Well, I'll take a shot at it, and I appreciate, Ben, your the concern. You know, I've been to Haines. I used to live in Southeast and have traveled up there to watch those fish make their way up the river and literally thousands of eagles, you know, enjoying that bounty. So I certainly appreciate that. We're going to be a responsible partner with the community there. And once our team has been up into the area, been able to cruise around, get a sense of the values of the various timber resources there. We will, I'm not going to make a statement right now exempting that. Again, we are legally allowed to go in, but just because we're legally allowed to go in doesn't mean necessarily that we will. We're going to assess that resource. We will absolutely take into consideration what Ben is talking about and many folks in the community have talked about in terms of the value of that incredible resource there, those bald eagles. So we'll see how it all comes out. I think our board of regents expressed their interest in this as well, out loud and in public in their recent meeting. And I think our guiding principles that the board of regents supported, that our negotiators will be taking into the room with them when they negotiate with the contractor, reflect that intent as well.
And I would add to that, we are working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife as well as the Department of Fish and Game, and we regularly do. So we do have a working relationship with them, and they will be involved. Matter of fact, we have already been working with them, and I expect that they may even come with us on some of our field efforts. So, just wanted to put that out there as well.
Are there other examples of places where you have had timber projects with similar environmental concerns as the Bald Eagle Preserve?
Well, I would say, you know, eagles are always a concern of people in our communities. I would bring forth our Edna Bay example. There are eagles and eagle nests in the area, and we have buffers around those locations. Fishing Game, Alaska Fishing Game, Department of Fishing Game, has been involved with us in those activities and kind of protecting the area so we don't disturb the birds.
Changing gears a little bit, one of the things some residents are excited about is the possibility of job creation here in the valley. Christine, how many jobs are expected to be generated by this sale?
Well, it will. Thank you for asking about that, because that's always something we look at, are the economics. It's important to us also as a university and a place of higher education is looking at how will the community benefit. That is one of our values. And we estimate 40 to 45 positions, and again, it will largely depend on the access, the infrastructure that is required and undertaken. I'm trying to think how many. We expected, I believe, 20 in construction, 20 to 25 in construction, and 20 to 25 in maritime. So it kind of depended on routes and what type of infrastructure is put in place, but easily 40 positions, I would say.
So I know we have just maybe six more minutes with the two of you. I want to make sure there is a chance to engage with some of the other guests in my studio here, if you would like. So I'm going to introduce the rest of my guests here. It's quite a crew in the studio. We have so many people that were sharing microphones. Tony Strong is here from the Chilkat Indian Village of Klukwan. Tony, welcome. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you.
We have two voices from the local timber industry here with us. Sylvia Hines is co-owner of Mud Bay Lumber Company and also a member of the Haines Planning Commission, and she's begun working with the university on a local action committee. Scott Rossman is also here. He's a longtime logger in the Chilkat Valley and owner of the Stump Company. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Oh, yep, thanks.
Habitat biologist Ben Kirkpatrick is here, and Hainesboro manager Deborah Schnabel is also here with us. Good morning, Deborah.
Good morning, thank you.
Thank you all for being here. Tony, I wanted to ask you, you have publicly expressed some concerns with this timber sale in the last couple months, and can you tell us about those, how you're feeling about this project?
There's a couple of thoughts that I wanted to share. One of them is the people who supposedly gave this land to the university didn't own it. The United States did not own this Chilkat Valley prior to 1972. Now, and supposedly they received it before statehood. Now, aside from that, I do still have some concerns. I have concerns because of the amount of clear-cutting that they're planning on doing, 13,000 to 15,000, and that includes land up around Klukwan. And that land around Klukwan has been our view since long before the United States existed. Now, they're planning on taking it away. They're planning on clear-cutting it. Clear-cutting is not necessarily a bad word, but certainly a sustained sustained yield is a much better approach, and that's what I'm urging. I'd like to see them figure out some way to cut smaller amounts rather than 13,000 in 10 years, and I think that's possible and it can still be done in a very sustainable and environmentally sound way.
Jim or Christine, do you want to respond to Tony?
Well, thanks. Good input, Tony. Until we actually assess the project a bit more and work with the contractor, I don't think all of it, you know, we use the word clear cut, and I appreciate very much your understanding. It's not necessarily a bad word, but it's going to, we want to make this a sustainable project. We want it to last over a period of time, and as I understand it, from those who know more about it than I do, this is not the first time this has been harvested. It's already been harvested, and so this is a second growth for us. But again, I think, you know, clear cut may be appropriate in some parts of it, other parts not so. So we'll just have to get a better sense of the appropriate best practice for harvesting, depending upon the particular area of the project. Christine, do you have anything you'd like to add there?
We have had sales in Haines of very, very small parcels. We have a 10-acre sale in the last 10 years. So we have been in Haines before. We have, no one seems to even recall that, but we have had some very small timber harvests for the local community, mostly for the small operators there. And I have heard that concern. In most of our sales, we do provide timber and opportunities for other small business owners. So I did want to put that out there. And I'm not sure exactly where the 10-acre parcel is. I need to check with one of my staff here.
Scott Rossman wanted to say something.
She was wondering where that 10-acre sale was, and it was next to Herman Creek, because I did it.
I wasn't sure if it was you, Scott, or not. So thank you.
So in just the last minute or so I have you here, Christine and Jim, is there anything else that you want to add? And could you just give us a sense of what happens now? Where are we headed?
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that. A couple of my staff, including myself, who have been kind of key on this particular project, are going to take a couple of weeks off for summer. But we will next, kind of the next step is to respond to all of the comments and concerns that were submitted. That is our practice, as we respond to them all. So that'll be the next step here out of our office. And then we will also get out on the ground with the contractor and others to take a look and get more detail and define the area more. We also want to be putting together, and Sylvia has been a very positive influence in terms of coming up with a great opportunity for a Haines Action Committee. And so Sylvia's been working with us a bit and others to start to put together that concept. I think she brought that up at our May meeting when we were down in May. And so those will kind of be the next steps that'll take, I suspect, us well into August and maybe the start of September at this point.
Yeah, thanks, Christine. Abby, if you don't mind, I'll add just a couple closing thoughts. And that is that, you know, the Board of Regents wants this project done well. They approve these guiding principles. I don't know if folks in the room have seen those, but they're publicly available. We will be following those guiding principles as we go forward with the project, and you know, they really emphasize the value that we'll seek, that it's all for educational purposes, that we'll use best practices in everything we do in this and every other project we lead, that you know, we're keenly interested in engaging with the community. That's why I really want to thank you and everybody else there this morning for participating here, because we want to be partners with the community as we go forward with this. And of course, you know, we're going to comply with all of the laws that apply, and there are quite a few of them. But our standards are higher than those
I just want that to be really clear. We want to be a responsible and a leader here in Alaska, and so even if the law allows us to do X, Y, or Z, we're really going to seek that higher ground, and we'll be a model for responsible resource development in Alaska. So thanks very much, Abby, and thanks to everybody there in the studio.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for being a part of the conversation today, and we look forward to hearing more from you as the process continues.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, you're listening to Lynn Canal Voice, and we're talking this hour about the University of Alaska's negotiated timber sale in the Chilkat Valley. With me in the studio here in Haines, as we have heard, is Ben Kirkpatrick, Tony Strong, Deborah Schnabel, Sylvia Hines, and Scott Rossman. We'll dig a little deeper now into the local impact, local history of timber in this valley. And to do that, I want to start with you, Sylvia, who I can barely see behind my screen here. Sylvia Hines, you and your husband operate a small local mill in Haines. And can you tell me a little bit about how long you've been in the timber business and how your small mill operates?
Okay. We've been milling for about 5 years, but this is our third year of official operation. And then this winter we upgraded our equipment so we can actually produce reliably, which is exciting. And what else did you want to know?
Just sort of how you operate, where you get the wood that you mill.
Okay.
And
So Chad and Scott here, we're logging pretty much after Christmas through, I don't know, April or so, up the highway. Scott would probably be able to talk more about that. He's been a huge... he's really made it possible for us to be able to be reliable and to operate and to have a functioning mill this year. Just as far as, you know, shop space and equipment, and he's been really great to work with. And so the trees most of our trees come from up the highway. It's been really great that Chad's been able to be out there and choose which trees we use and be able to hand pick them and be able to really make the best boards from the best part of the tree.
And Scott, can you do the same? Can you tell me a little bit about your history in the timber industry in this valley? You've been working in this industry for quite a while now.
32 years, I guess. Be 88, I started logging here in Alaska, and probably in late 90s, I kind of went on my own because the whole timber industry had more or less went away. So out of the ashes of that came four or five of us that have been, logging here and making a living on the state forest since then.
I'd love to talk a little bit about that, sort of how you've seen this industry change in the time that you've been involved in it.
Well, that's basically it. It went from a high point in the 90s and the 80s to nothing by 2000. And part of it because the pulp mills shut down in Sitka and in Ketchikan, and that affected markets here. And because of that, really the only thing left was local markets, just stuff, rough sawn lumber and firewood for here. When those markets went away, either had to fill a ship with 5 million feet or be me and a couple other guys that dibble and dabble here. There's no in between.
And I lost my train of thought there, so I would like to turn to Tony as well. Tony, you've been here through that progression.
Yes, and I do remember it quite well. John Schnabel operated a sawmill here. My dad worked for him. Some of my brothers worked for him, and we were able to provide for our family, a very large family. But that was local production. It wasn't clear cut and send them out. There was some period of time where that was done. But the operations that Sylvia is talking about and Scott are talking about, that I think is a sustainable yield kind of operation, not just cut them off and cut them down and send them out. I think that the kind of operation that they illustrate to us is what I think would be useful for long-term development here in Haines. In addition to that, the amount of lumber or people they're talking about hiring, they're talking about bringing in an outside timber company, an outside company. And in my experience, when they hire outside companies, they bring in their own crew. So we're talking about bringing in more crew who are going to establish themselves here. And when the timber industry goes out, they'll be in a position like Scott is. They don't have a job. So we'll have economic crises down the road. So I think it's better for the university to take the kind of approach that Sylvie and Scott are using and the kind of operation that we had with John Schnabel. So some thoughts.
Now, Sylvia, something that we've talked about is you were telling me about how you feel sort of the local operations and larger scale projects go hand in hand in a way.
Historically, that my understanding is that's how it's been. And us small operators have really piggybacked off of large scale industry. And I'm sure Scott can talk a lot more about that. So we've really depended on it. And in the last few years, I've been racking my brain, talking to a lot of people and really putting, you know, since we haven't had these large scale, first of all, since we haven't had these large scale sales. And second of all, because there's so much support for small scale operators. I think because it does have the environment, it is environmentally sustainable. It has a huge social value, and it's an economically sustainable for long term. It doesn't have that boom and bust aspect to it. But if we are, so I really believe that the local timber industry has a place in Haines that has huge potential and has a ton of value for Haines. But with that, if we want it to be sustainable and we want to keep doing it, then we need to figure out how to be independent. What I've been trying to do is figure out how to be independent from these large scale sales. And I haven't come up with anything. I haven't been able, you know, with the, you know, the research and talking to people and trying to, I haven't been able to find ways to, So with that, like, if as a community we want to be independent from that, if that's what people decide, like, we really need to be thinking 10 years ahead, and we really need to be figuring out how to, I don't think it's useful to be for this timber sale or against this timber sale. I think it's useful to see these types of developments strategically and try to look at the costs, look at the benefits, and be able to strategically figure out how to set ourselves up to be a sustainable community. We're barging so much in, and there are so many potential jobs and so much potential manufacturing and potential, there's so much potential that we could be doing to make ourselves more independent. And I feel a responsibility to my generation and to my kids to be able to create something that is awesome.
Ben, I want to bring you back into the conversation. You have a long history in habitat in this valley, and I'm curious, beyond what we talked about earlier with the Bald Eagle Preserve, sort of how you're looking at this particular project and issues that you may see.
Well, thanks again, Abby. To look at it in a bigger picture, I was very fortunate for many years to be the habitat biologist in the Upper Lynn Canal. I was very fortunate to be trained how to review projects by the best fish biologists and scientists in Southeast Alaska, whether it's Fish and Game, Forest Service, and other agencies. And so there's many things you look for when you're reviewing a project. So one of the key things is you want to make sure you have all the information first. And also, you want to be involved early in the process. If the process develops without adequate input, it's very hard to get things to change. And of course, there are many things that are not known about this. So one of the things you can do is look at projects that are occurring. One example during my years working for Fish and Game is I conducted numerous inspections of university logging in the Icy Bay area. To be honest, I was very unimpressed, and that would be a place to look at. That finished logging probably over 10 years ago anyway. And how is that area doing? Obviously, they don't have an eagle preserve. They don't have a community there. But still, this was a university project. They probably, at least on paper, followed all the rules. Another thing, today as we speak, I think everybody in this room and listening realizes that our diminished king salmon are running up the river as we speak. Fish and Game has limited access to these fish to conserve them as they rightly should. But also, at the very same time, while these king salmon are migrating during high water, DOT is end dumping large quantities of material into these same waters instead of waiting for the king salmon to pass, as they're requiring fishermen to do. So these are short-term impacts. It's the same with long-term impacts on the highway, where instead of providing for king salmon habitat, they're putting thousands of feet of new riprap into the river. And so these are the same people who are going to be regulating and permitting any logging, any mining, or any other type of development industries. So if we are concerned about these, we cannot sit back and wait for the university, Fish and Game, or others to look out for our best interests. It's very important as a community that if we have concerns, that we step up and make sure that they are known.
Scott, I remembered the question I wanted to ask you. and that was just, so we were talking a little about the history of logging. You remembered that area that Christine Klein was trying to remember. And so I'm just curious if you have an idea of this map that the university has put out, if you can help us understand which areas have been logged in the past. Do you have a sense of that?
I have not actually looked at the map, but I do know basically all the areas that the university owns, just by memory. I guess just like they were saying earlier, there's large parcels of it that might as well be on the moon. It's not going to happen under any conditions, just because of where the physical features of where they lay. And there's also a large quantity of it that has been logged in the 60s and 70s. And I spent all winter logging on state forest right next to university property that was logged at the same time. And, you know, it's trees that grew back that are 50 years old, and the bigger ones are the ones they left behind. So it's marginal commercial value to me. I mean, I looked at it and I could do it, but I have a hard time believing that a large outfit could make money on this particular parcel of land that I'm thinking of. But in the end, there's very little of it, I think, that's going to be commercially viable. But that's just my opinion, having done it myself over the years. We'll see how this all shakes down.
Sure. Tony and then Sylvia.
The other part about it that I grew up here, and I don't remember ever seeing clear cutting of any kind over across the river, the Chilkat River, as I drove up the highway. I remember that the cutting that was being done was done up in Mosquito Lake, up in Kelso. That's where my family participated. I don't remember seeing clear cutting across the river or even in downtown, up even a 7 Mile. I don't, in my memory, there was never there.
There was a private timber sale across the Circu on the flats, just on the north side of the ridge going into Chilkat Lake. And that was a 160-acre parcel that was owned privately, and that was clear-cut. But I don't think there's been any state land clear-cut, but Scott might have the answer to that.
But if you're talking across the river from Clequan, basically, right?
Well, that and all the way down the highway.
I mean, from the Circu River at the Chilkat Lake Landing back towards the farm all the way to Porcupine Road, that whole area was logged in the 60s. Even before there was a bridge, they put winter bridges in and went across, like at 23 Mile.
I do remember that, but I'm talking about going down the
highway. Oh, down the highway, no. Yeah, I agree.
There's a really incredible map at the museum right now, at the Forest to Finish exhibit, that shows all the different landowners and also shows historical logging, pre-statehood and post-statehood, and really worth checking out as far as that Greg Palmieri put together. So,
Deborah, you had something to add?
I have lots of things that are floating through my mind in response to the conversations here, but I'd like to bring it back right now to the university proposal. And one of the things that struck me here in listening to them talk and have this discussion now, I think that the community generally is rallying around the concept of having a sustainable industry. And when Mr. Johnson and Ms. Klein were talking and they continue to use the word project, it struck me that that is something that we might want to think about. A project is something that has a beginning and an end, and definitely the university has conceived of this as a project, and it has a beginning and an end. And the community, it seems to me, is talking more about the possibility of creating it. We recognize that the impact is going to be life-changing for many. As Tony pointed out, people will move into the community to take advantage of the jobs that will be short-term, and I use short-term, 10 years is short-term. And then move out. I think the community, and this is the thing that the assembly, I think, has wanted to address most clearly, is, and Sylvia's mentioned it also, how can we impact this project to elongate it and make it into something that would be more beneficial to the community and to the environment over the very long term, which we might consider to be longer than 30 years, because the boom and bust that we've already lived through, I think, was probably about 30 years. As Scott mentioned, it ended like in 2000. It was over. And we've all been trying to clamor to find a new definition of ourselves. We used to be a timber town, and we are not anymore. And I don't know that we want to, I think that we want to integrate timber industry into a larger picture of the economy and not make us dependent on that one thing. So that's one of the things that I think is important for us to communicate to the university at this time. Is the nature of the what they're calling a contract or the sale, I think is very important to us, that if we can find a way to influence the terms of the contract so that they can be elongated and extend, so that people can make investments, so that people can, like Sylvia, can think in terms of, you know, I think I can invest in a lathe, or I think I can invest in a kiln dryer. I can't do it if the timber supply is going to be over in 10 years. I have to have a longer supply of timber. So I think those, a lot of times it's when we look at the vocabulary, and if we could stop talking about this as a project and turn it into an industry, I think that would be cool.
Because there are a lot of other parts of our economy right now, tourism and fishing, and you were saying to integrate it into the greater economy.
One of the thoughts I had that might be useful for somebody like Scott and Sylvia is that instead of having a proposed clear cut of large 13,000, 15,000 acres of land, is having logging roads built into smaller areas that will give access to some of those timber that would be used for the kind of operation that would be a sustained yield and usable on a smaller scale than clear cutting 15,000 acres.
I'd just like to comment on that too. And that's another key project or a key concept here is the economies of scale. We can't expect somebody to build a road at the cost of $200,000 to access, you know, just the primo trees. So unless the primo trees are going to, like, go into the music market only or whatever. But, you know, that's the economies of scale are very important to this whole project. And one of the things, it may be that we have to compromise by in terms of seeing a large scale some export of round logs that supports the construction of the roads that then allows us to have the small set-aside timber sale or patches, I guess, for the selective sale to small millers in the area.
Deborah, I want to stick with you just for a few minutes because we are running short on time. Hour has just flown by. And I did want to touch base with you. There's been some things happening on the assembly level, some correspondence with the university. Yes. And I just want to make sure, you know, we're clear on sort of what that has been and what the last letter that the assembly sent to the university was.
The assembly has sent three letters to the university. Well, two, and one is in the out box. It was the first one was in April, prior to the May 9th meeting. And at that time, we asked to be stakeholders, or the assembly did, on the behalf of the community, to participate more fully in the design and the development of the timber sale contract, because we were aware at that time that this idea of having a more sustainable industry was very important and paramount. We asked that the university consult with its own Department of Economic Development, which happens to be a whole school of thought about coming into communities and helping them to figure out how to make industry sustainable. Then, the next was on May 22nd. On May 22nd, the assembly did tell the university that it was withholding its support or non-support. It was going to be non-committal about its take on the industry or on the project until they had a meeting with the lands office. And we have not had a meeting directly with the lands office in the manner that the assembly would like to see happen. So things, I would say that the relationship between the assembly and the university lands department right now is it needs nurturing and care, because we haven't quite seen eye to eye on where we're going.
We have only 5 more minutes here, so I want to give each of you a chance to share any parting words. There's so much more we could talk about, and we will continue to talk about as things progress with the university sale. But for now, let's start with Ben. Anything you want to say?
I think I just repeat what I heard. I believe Tony said is logging, mining, road building is not inherently evil. It's totally not. We all depend on that as a community, on these infrastructure and business. But it's all about how you regulate it and permit it, and that is ultimately up to us as residents to have an influence on.
Scott Rossman, anything else you want to say?
Along with lines of what Deborah was saying about the large scale supporting the small scale, because basically for the last 20 years I've been picking up the pieces of what was left behind, and I am seeing the end of that. And so, like she says, with logging roads costing $200,000 and $300,000 and $400,000 and $500,000 a mile, it's not something I'm going to do anytime soon, you know. So somewhere in there, something has to happen. I'm not sure what, but for sure, if there was an outfit here that did it and the university laid it out in such a way that some timber was left, that it would benefit the small. But they're not going to want to, because once you put the road in, they're going to want to log every stick of timber they can off of that road. But I hope they don't.
Tony.
I'm expressing the things Ben said and Deborah said, and all of us have talked about we need a sustained economy, not a boom and bust. And that boom and bust is not going to just, should not be just destroying all of our other economies, the the tourist industry, the people who come up here to enjoy our environment. And once this project gets done, that environment will be diminished in a huge way. And it may impact, even though they're talking about it, about being careful, I expect it'll have a huge impact on our fisheries, and therefore it's going to have an impact on the life of the eagles and the ravens and the other life that depends on the flow of that river and the cleanliness of it.
Sylvia, anything else you want to say?
I think just to kind of repeat the kind of historical relationship that the small-scale industry has had with large-scale export. And, again, before the university brought up this sale, before, with the kind of with the Baby Brown sale and other things, and talking to Scott and realizing that we, maybe only have a few more years of access to trees, and seeing, 92% support in Haines for local timber industry, which is huge. And I think, again, is to the I think that there's a reason for that support. It's something that's very valuable to us, having a local industry that is thriving. And again, I hear a lot of fight against against the sale or support for the sale. And I think that as a community, it will benefit us to try to think more strategically how to mitigate the costs of large-scale industry and how to take advantage of the opportunities to be able to think 10 years ahead and 20 years ahead and 30 years ahead. And I guess I'm trying to be careful about being reactionary personally. And I think that as a town, we have so many intelligent people, so many people with different experiences and different backgrounds that we can do something great, but we have to be careful of being reactionary.
And Deborah Schnabel, just before I turn to you, I'm just going to say this is KHNS Haines, Skagway, and Klukwan. We are continuing on, but this is the top of the hour. So Deborah Schnabel, any last thoughts?
I really appreciate Sylvia's comments. I think it's important for all of us to not to observe ourselves and the way we respond to any proposal, not just this one, but any proposal that comes forward in the community, and to ask ourselves to be rational and to listen to the other person and what their proposal is, and to offer constructive comments. And that I think that's an important message, and I just want to repeat it. Thank you, Sylvia.
I also wanted to add that it's important to the university, as Deborah suggested, for them to sit down and talk with us. And as Ben said, we need to plan this together. They shouldn't just come in and clean out.
Well, thank you all for being here. Tony Strong, Sylvia Hines, Scott Rossman, Ben Kirkpatrick, and Deborah Schnabel. Really appreciate you being here today. And that is it for Lynn Canal Voice today, but it's not the end of our coverage of this sale, so if you have thoughts, concerns, questions, please reach out. We're at 766-2020 or 983-2853, and I'm at news@khns.org. And that is it for Lynn Canal Voice. The audio from this show will be posted online at khns.org if anyone missed it. This is KHNS, Haines, Skagway, and Klukwan.